And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and we welcome back John Scalzi to the program today. He's a journalist, blogger, and writer of nonfiction, and he's enjoyed a great deal of success as a science fiction novelist. He's written several standalone novels, like the Hugo Award-winning Red Shirts, but today we'll be talking about the sixth entry into his Old Man's War series, and it's entitled The End of All Things. Now, John, with your previous book in the Old Man War series, you released it serially in 9 parts. But with the new book, The End of All Things, it's 4 parts.
Right.
Why the downshift in the number of parts?
Well, with The Human Division, which was actually 13 parts, but you know, the point of that was we were really interested to see whether people would be interested in episodic storytelling, whether they would pay for each episode, and what would happen with that. With The Human Division and with The End of All Things, which is the new book, they are essentially experiments by Tor and by me. Tor had come to me and said, we are interested in doing some stuff digitally and kind of having a serial sort of thing, which dovetailed very well with me wanting to tell some stories in the Old Man's universe that weren't necessarily novel length. So we said, let's combine and basically look to see where the market is. And so they were basically experiments to see whether people would buy, what they're interested in buying, what the response would be to having short stories. So we did that with Human Division with 13 short stories. And then with The End of All Things, we wanted to see how they felt about novellas. So there are 4 novellas in The End of All Things. And just like with The Human Division, each of those novellas is largely standalone. If you only read that one novella, you will still get a pretty satisfying reading experience. But if you stack all of them up, one on top of the other, you will see a narrative arc there that is a novel-length narrative arc. So for us, it's just basically trying to see what people like and what they don't like. I mean, we're in a very exciting time right now with publishing, that you don't have to just put out a novel. I mean, you see that by the fact that a lot of the publishing companies are now doing novella imprints. Like Tor has their Tor.com imprint. Other science fiction publishers are doing the same sort of thing. And what that – they're taking advantage of the fact that with the arrival of electronic publishing, it's not just the here's a novel. We know that will sell and it has to be this size. It can be, well, here's a story. It is – exactly the right size for the story, but it's 30,000 words instead of 60,000 or 80,000. Let's see if we can sell it electronically. So the fact that they're beginning to experiment with the form and seeing what people are willing to pay for each of those is really exciting. And like I said, for us, with both The Human Division and The End of All Things, each of these, in addition to telling a story and me as a writer having the challenge of telling the story in those particular ways, is also an exploration on the business end of things. I mean,
so how did The Human Division shake out?
The Human Division did very, very well.
Which versions?
Which versions?
Yeah, so you have the 13 standalones, then you have the hardcover, and then you theoretically, I guess, have a collection of the 13 and as an ebook.
Right. Well, and here's the thing that we found very, very interesting, which was that we didn't cannibalize the sales of the print version. What we found was that there is a digital audience, and these people are really tied in with digital. They really like digital. That is how they prefer to read. There is a print audience. These are the people who love the feel of the book, who give the books as gifts, that sort of thing. There's overlap, obviously, but there's enough of a differentiation between these two audiences that they didn't cannibalize each other. We kind of believe that there is a cannibalization electronically with mass market paperback. I mean, that has kind of rolled into electronic. But with hardcover, it really is still two separate audiences. So we sold literally hundreds of thousands of episodes of The Human Division. And we wondered, well, what is that going to mean for the book when it comes out? Is it just going to come out and then nobody will buy it because they already have episodically? And no, what we found out was the print sales were directly in line with what the Old Man's War series had done in print and hardcover before. The ebook, as a compiled ebook, sold just as well. So we didn't actually see any sort of downside to that. So that was actually really exciting for us, because what it means is that the potential – there's always been this great concern that there's a decline in readership or there's a decline in the amount of books that you can sell because we live in this particular era. But the fact of the matter is strictly from a business end, what we're seeing is that the audiences are in some ways expanding. On top of this, an independent is audiobook. And audiobook has just really exploded recently.
I see in the blog entry about your recent standalone novel, Lock In.
Right, Right, exactly. That, you know, it went from being this sort of niche thing that came out when your book came out, and then once you went into backlist, it went away. Now is a persistent thing, and there is really a large group of people who are native readers in audio. So it's just become this huge new market. And again, it's a market that doesn't have a whole lot of overlap with either the direct digital or the print market. So from my point of view, and what, like I said, what we've been finding with the Human Division and the End of All Things, is it's a great time, A, to be experimenting, B, to be publishing, because you get to address these different markets basically where they are. I mean, my philosophy as a writer, as a business person who writes as well, is how do you want to read the book? You want to read it in digital? Great, here it is. You want to read it in print? Wonderful, here it is. You want it in audio? Let me serve that up to you. Wherever the readers are, that's where we want to be.
And Audible even gave you two different narrators for two different versions of Lock In.
Right, exactly, because for narrative reasons, that made sense to do it. But that's exactly goes to the point. I mean, Tor was doing this thing where they, you know, tried 13 stories episodically week after week after week, and it could have failed miserably. We didn't know, but we had to see, we had to try it and find out. Audible gave me the two different narrators because the story demanded it. We didn't know whether people would go for that or if they would feel like it was double dipping. And what we've actually found out is the people who bought one go back and they want to buy the other one, often buy the other one out of their own free will without any resentment, because they're like, this was cool the way Amber did it. Now I want to hear how Will did it. Amber Benson and Will Wheaton being the narrators. So they kind of do it so that they can get a completely different experience with a completely different narrator. They're excited about it as opposed to feeling like it's a cheap shot.
So how do you think Tor and Audible come to you so that you're so adaptable and so congenial to trying these new things?
There's two reasons for it. I mean, I think the first is, and this is something that's kind of been a thread in my career, which is that I'm very active on the business side of things. I really believe that I am running a small business and that I have to tend to the business side of things. So part of that is that when they come to me and say, we have this, we want to experiment with this, and here's the reason why we're doing it, basically part of it is seeing a business opportunity and to find out more about where the market is, to get more data so that I can inform myself and hopefully inform other people as well, as like, this is the state of the market right now. Because all that information is important if I want to continue to have a career 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the line. You have to do it like that. So they know that I'm amenable to trying new things for the research, right? For the science. The other thing is that as a writer, I just think it's cool, right? You know, one of the things that I like to do is with every new book, with everything that I do, I like to try to do something that I haven't done before. And sometimes it's not a big deal. Like, for example, in Lock-In, aside from any other thing, I wrote the book without semicolons, right? Which sounds like a kind of a silly thing. But the fact is that it really introduces a completely different rhythm to what you're doing, right? Because I am someone who loves semicolons. Just
semicolon, however, comma.
Yeah, it's just my entire thought process is one run-on sentence with 17 semicolons on it. So that's
is that from your philosophy background?
It really may be. It really may be. But the thing is so when I'm writing, I will write and then I will look at the paragraph I've just written, and it is one sentence, six semicolons, and I have to go out and edit it. And that is a problem. So I wrote it without semicolons, and it made a difference in just kind of the rhythm of things. Another time, I wrote a book in third person where I had never done that. My first two books were in first person. Every time you do something, you try to do something new to add to your toolbox or to improve on weaknesses or to just try something to see how it works. So when Tor came to me and said, we want to make a novel out of a collection of short stories and have each of those short stories kind of be a standalone story, yet at the same time have a narrative arc going on. I was like, that sounds cool. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm willing to try. And with Audible, with the two narrator things, I mean, that was them and me sitting down and going, what is going to be the thing that is best for the book, that really works so that the book has a presentation that most accurately is in line with what I originally intended, but is also something that we can look at and use as a device to get people's attention. And so not only was the two narrator thing right from a aesthetic and a literature point of view, but it was also a really cool thing to do from a business point of view to differentiate that particular book out. And I'm, like I said, I'm always willing to try something that might be a little bit different or might be a little bit weird, as long as there's two things going on, that you're not just doing it just to do it, that it ties into the storytelling, it ties into the marketing, it ties into the, you know, basically delivering something that is interesting to people, and also that it is something that we feel the experience of doing it is going to be worth it. If it's a failure, it's a failure, but if we can still learn from it, great. If we're just throwing it out like, you know, let's be edgy, then no, I would rather not do that. I always want to have a purpose to the things that I'm doing beyond just, you know, the novelty factor.
So when do we get the book Scalzi on the Business of Writing?
Well, I had a book called You're Not Fooling Anyone When You Take Your Laptop Into a Coffee Shop, which is a book on writing, which came out in 2007. And it's been a while since I've updated it, so I might do another book like that sometime in the next couple of years, simply because it would be time. But as it happens, I do have contractual obligations. If I do that, it will have to be in the spaces between the things that I already owe Tor and Audible.
Well, let's get back to the end of all things.
Okay, let's.
And as you said, four novellas, each told with a first-person narrator, so you had to get a lot of different voices going in this.
Right, yeah. And for me as a writer, the hardest thing to do is begin the novel. Like, I will spend like 2 months writing that first chapter just trying to find the right tone, the right voice, the right circumstance to get it going. And you have to do that each time you do a first-person narrative, because if you don't nail that person's tone right, then nothing works. So that is the hardest part of doing a novel for me. Once I've got that first chapter and that voice and everything else kind of goes fairly quickly. Well, with this thing, I had to do it four separate times. And with a short story, you can kind of jump in and jump out and it's fine, right? It's very short, 6,000 words, 10,000 words, whatever. If you're doing a novella, they can be anywhere from, you know, 20,000, 30,000 words. So it's a substantial amount of writing. So for me, in a very real sense, this was like beginning four entirely new novels, right?
So how do you do this to yourself?
Well, that is one of the questions that I ask myself. Again, it kind of comes back to, well, I've never done this before. Let's try it. What I've learned is that for me, it was just as difficult to write a novella or to start a novella as it is to start a novel, which meant that this book came dangerously close to the edge of when I could actually production had to get started on it. Like, I finished it like literally days before it absolutely had to be in. So it was a fascinating experience, and it was great, and I learned a lot, and I'm never doing it again ever because that was just an amazing amount of work.
Now, the first novella is called Life of the Mind, mm-hmm. and it makes me think of Barton Fink.
Well, that. You're not the only one. It wasn't necessarily meant to be a direct nod to that. But I love Barton Fink. And of course, as I was writing it, you know, there is John Goodman in my brain going, I will show you the life of the mind.
And Rafe did show them the life of the mind.
He certainly did. So it was definitely there. And certainly when it went out into the world, people are like, you know, wow, Barton Fink much? And I'm like, I'm not going to deny that that was running through it. But on the other hand, for that particular novella, that was the right title. And I'm not going to miss a good title just because it refers to something else. Like, for example, with Lock-In, I have the sequel, which is part of the contract that I have with Tor, is going to be called Head-On. And there's a reason that it's called Head-On. But immediately people are like, Head-On, you mean apply to the forehead? Yeah, apply to the forehead? I'm like, I'm going to have to kill you now. Because of those stupid ads.
You know, I never actually saw one of the ads.
I never saw them.
I always heard about them, but never saw them.
I've seen all the parody versions of it, apply to the forehead, you know, but I've never actually seen one of them. And I think I actually had to, like, someone tried to send it to me after, you know, I said the sequel to Lock-In is going to be called Head On. And they're like, oh, you mean like this? I'm like, I'm not even going to click that link. I want my mind unsullied. But the thing is that I will probably have to refer to the apply to foreheads, put it somewhere in the book, kind of like an Easter egg.
But this gives me the idea of like a story or something about a culture that only exists in parody and no one knows the source material anymore.
I was about to say, it's called the internet. You've been there, right? It's that is, you know,
the, but the entirety.
It's like the Star Trek Next Generation episode where Picard meets.
He only speaks in the mythology.
Yeah, he only speaks in the mythology. Only speaks in metaphors. You know, and so Jalad and Tengara, you know, at Tengara and all that sort of stuff is now a reference on the internet, and there are people who use it who don't know where it comes from. And I think you can get perilously close to this. Like, for example, my daughter, who is very smart. She's 16 years old. She knows tons and tons of references to movies and stuff like that. She doesn't know them from the movies. She knows them from Family Guy, right? Because Family Guy will reference them, and she will go, that's funny. And then when someone else makes a reference to a movie, she'll be like, oh, I know that reference. And you're like, where is it from? Family Guy? No. No. And I want to get on her about it, but then I realized that I did exactly the same thing, except for my Family Guy was Looney Tunes, right? Mm-hmm. You know, where they had all those cartoons where they'd have Bugs Bunny and Donald Duck interacting with at the Brown Derby, you know, in L.A. So they would be with the movie stars of the 30s and 40s and stuff like that. And so the first place that I ever recognized Humphrey Bogart, you know, when I saw Casablanca when I was like 8, I was like, that's the guy from the Looney Tunes. And I'm sure my mother was horrified. So
one of my favorite ones, there was an emo band called Jets to Brazil back in the 90s.
Of course there was.
And I said, man, that's just an odd name. And then I just happened to be watching Breakfast at Tiffany's on TCM one morning. And Holly had a poster in her room that said Jets to Brazil.
There you go. The naming of bands, as you know, is a very, very serious subject. It has to be something that's evocative but not too vulgar. And so it's always a problem. But there's so many like weird little phrases that could make for great bands. I actually have a Tumblr, which is called nextbandname.tumblr.com, where I have a collection of just phrases and words and stuff like that I think would be great for a next band. I've got like 500 of them now.
I always did imaginary song titles.
Yeah, it's the same sort of thing, or album titles. And that's the thing is, like, you would like a phrase and you would ask yourself, is this an album title or is it a band name? Because these things are important, because if you get them wrong, then it all goes, it gets shot. It's terrible.
My favorite one is The Bitter Redhead with Tourette's.
That's a song title.
I know. That's what it was.
That's indeed what it is.
Now, speaking of names.
Yeah.
Science fiction, naming especially things that are off-planet, it can be quite a challenge.
Here's how I do it. And I tell people this is how I do it, and then they say, no, you can't possibly do that. That's just the wrong way to do it. But it's how I do it. So I take something like a book or object or name, and I cut off the first letter of it and the last letter of it. And if it looks like it still works, then I put it in. So, like, I have a Coca-Cola thing here. So I would remove the C and remove, like, the L-A at the end. So you have an alien species called Okoko. The Okoko from the planet Okokol, you know? And people are like, you don't really do that. I'm like, yes, I do. Because naming things is hard.
And so that's why so many of these names are 3 to 5 syllables. They're because almost everyone has a short name. I saw there's one character near the end of the book that had almost like kind of like a Laotian length name.
Right, right, right.
But most everything is like 3 to 5 syllables.
Right, right, right. Yeah, no, that's exactly how I do it. And because what you need to do is that when you name something, you don't want it to be so weird and convoluted that it just slips out of people's minds, unless you're only going to do it once. But all the rest of the time, you want them to have something that sticks in their brain. So it's short, it's sweet, it's to the point. And it really works. Like, I'm looking over here. You have a collection of books behind you. And there is a title there that says, Before He Finds, and then I can't see the rest of it. But slice off the B, slice off the end at the end. E4. The E4 are members of the conclave, right? And it works great because, you know, they are the pieces of language that we know already work and that people will be able to remember, and it just sticks in their brain.
But aren't we so lucky that everyone's named after human phonemes on our...
Well, you know, it is one of those. I do have in the human division, I have a guy whose name is... That's his name. And the reason that his name is that is because I wanted William Dufresne, who is the narrator of the human division, to go... And he did. That was the one time where I didn't have it as just regular phonemes. And it was purely to make the narrator do something ridiculous. And now that I've admitted that, I'm sure that he will put a contract out on my life. I am sorry, William Dufresne. But it was awesome.
But how do you approach silliness? Because you do have a sense of humor, and, sure. and it does show up in your books. So how do you know when something is silly enough but not too silly?
It's a fine line, and it's not something that you necessarily hit for everybody. Humor is horribly, horribly idiosyncratic. The one book of mine that has the widest dynamic range of reviews, from just amazingly positive, this is one of the best books and changed my life, to I cannot believe this dreck was published, there's something wrong with our society, is Red Shirts, because Red Shirts is meant to be a funny book. And I have this theory that, like, I'm going to write a dramatic scene, right? And the point of this dramatic scene is to make you cry. Okay? So if it works 100%, then you cry as you're reading it. If it works 80%, you get a lump in your throat. If it works 60%, you're like, oh, you know, that's sad, right? It fails gracefully. Even if it's not working at full strength for you, then it still works. With humor, it either works or it doesn't. If it works, then you laugh or you think it's funny. And if it doesn't, then you get kind of annoyed and you get kind of angry because I was promised a joke and this was not a joke. Are you kidding me? This is not a joke. And so you go in writing humorous stuff with the understanding that there is, it's not going to work for everybody, that there is that line. It's a very sharp division. And basically what I end up doing is I write to my sense of humor. I think my sense of humor is generally fairly broad enough that most people will get it and it's generally applicable. But even then, you know, even in the ones that are not directly meant to be humorous but have humorous moments in it, you know, there will be people who come, I think that whole thing worked except for that one part where you tried to be funny. And you're just kind of like, I'm sorry that didn't work for you. There's nothing that I can do because clearly your sense of humor isn't mine. My wife and I were talking about that today too as she drove me to the airport. I was talking about the simple fact that, you know, like, 5-10 years ago, maybe, Dane Cook was the most popular comedian in the United States. And I just find nothing about him amusing. It doesn't mean the people who find him amusing were wrong. It's just this is a sense of humor that so does not work for me that I actually, whenever I see him, I just immediately turn off the TV because I know that I'm not going to be entertained.
I heard someone recently describe him as the cheerleader for going out. And that's, he wasn't a comedian. He was just the cheerleader for going out to a bar.
That could very much be the case. But on the other hand, he was arguably the most popular comedian 5-10 years ago, whenever it was that, you know, we hit peak Dane Cook. And you can't argue with it. You can't argue with what people like or dislike. Their tastes are their own. What you hope for when you're a writer is that what you're writing is understandable enough so that people's response to it, even if it doesn't hit for them 100%, is they still go, yeah, I know where you're going with this and I can continue going on with the story.
Well, I was happy to know that humans in the future do value the concept of Taco Tuesday and Pizza Friday.
You know, Taco Tuesday is one of those time-honored traditions that I think is going to survive for hundreds and hundreds of years. But there's another reason to do stuff like Taco Tuesday and Pizza Friday, because Pizza Friday is really the most important day of the entire week, is Taco Tuesday and Pizza Friday are in the third novella of The End of All Things. And one of the things that I want to do very quickly is to give you a sense of the relationship between these four people who constitute this military squad, and that their banter is back and forth is the same as your banter back and forth, you know, with your coworkers. That it's not about anything that's particularly consequential, you know, but it is a joy simply to be talking to the people that you like, right? I mean, we were talking before we had the formal interview. We were just talking about guitars and talking about, you know, TV and stuff like that. And we were not – it had absolutely no consequence one way or the other. But it was enjoyable. We had a good time. And, you know, we established a little bit of a rapport. That's what friendships are built on. That's what getting to know people is built on. It's just that, you know, very common sort of back and forth. And so for me as a writer, I wanted to establish that these characters do actually care about each other, that they can poke at each other, they can make fun of each other, they can say silly things. They have a shared point of reference, and that shared point of reference was, hey, remember in junior high, Taco Tuesday, and off we are to the races. They make them identifiable so that later when I do horrible things to them, you'll feel bad. You know, it's not just conversation for conversation's sake when I'm writing it. There's intent for it. But for the characters, it is conversation for conversation's sake because they're friends.
Now, let's go back to the first novella, Life of the Mind. And basically, it's picking up where we left off in the Human Divisions in that they find a ship. There's a brain in a box. Mm-hmm. And this one's narrated by the brain in the box.
Right, right. Well, there are two things that had to happen there. The first was I ended the last book on a cliffhanger, which meant that a large proportion of my readership wanted to murder me. They weren't going to murder me because then they would never know what happened because it's a cliffhanger. So that was great for me. But they were like, you have to tell us what's going on. So I knew that right off I needed to explain one of the great mysteries of the previous book and just go running with it. And the other thing is I needed a character who is directly in the middle of whatever this grand conspiracy is. And it couldn't be the folks who were the main protagonists of the last book. It couldn't be Harry Wilson or Odea Bumway or any of the B team of diplomats. It had to be because whatever that they were doing, it would be responding to whatever the conspiracy is as opposed to actively being in the middle of it, which the main character of Life of the Mind is. And so for me, that meant taking someone who's basically put in a situation against his will and literally been turned into a brain in a box. It's not a spoiler to note that. And to tell that story from that person's point of view. And also to give some sort of idea of what it would be like to all of a sudden be a normal, able-bodied person and then suddenly be only your mind.
So we're thinking Johnny got his gun.
Well, you know, yeah, exactly. And the thing is that there's – the thing about it is, again, it's a fine line to do because you have to – you have to tell a story and you have to make sure that your narrator in this particular case, you don't necessarily have to do it with everything, but in this particular case, is cogent and collected enough that you have a narrative flow to the story. So there's a lot – I mean it's very, very streamlined representation of what it would be like to be in this particular situation. We don't talk a lot about, for example, you know, the psychosis that would come from isolation or the hallucinations that come from that sort of isolation, even though I'm sure that they were happening to him at the time because I had that particular story to tell. That said, you do want to make sure that you have – at least some of that in there. So it was a really fascinating character to write, to both serve the story and keep things moving forward while at the same time at least making sure that people have some flavor of what it must be like to be in that particular position.
And at the beginning he says, I'm not a writer. I don't know how to put this down. So how do you kind of mimic that in the flow of the story?
It was a great gift to me, so I didn't have to worry about it being too artful. it's like, and now the writer cheats. I'm not an author. You know, I'm not a writer, he said, the writer said. But part of that is also the guy's a brain in a box. He's not typing. He's dictating. And so I wrote that novella pretty much like this guy is dictating what had happened to him. So the flow of that particular novella is really meant to evoke somebody talking, somebody, you know, going on, and then this happened, and then he said this, and then I said that, and then here's what I thought about that, and because really what this was a ridiculous thing, and so on and so forth, whereas other novellas are much more conventionally writerly, if you want to say it. What I did is I wrote it, and then I read it out. And anything that sounded too much like it was coming out of a fingertip instead of a mouth, I reworked it so that it sounded more like it was being spoken instead of written. Because there is a difference. There is a difference between what is being written, you know, what your language is like when you're writing it and what your language is like when you're speaking it. They really – I don't know that they actually come from different parts of the brain, but at least in my sort of conception of it, they certainly do. I don't necessarily always write like I speak. My writing is much more considered than my speech. So when I was writing this character, I made sure that his tone, his patter, his writing was much more speech-like than not.
And so he is made to be a brain in a box by a force called the equilibrium.
Right.
And does that have echoes with communism, equilibrium, things being equal?
No. Although I can see where it might seem that way. No. I think what happened, the theory behind the equilibrium is there's the conclave, which is a a very large agglomeration of alien species, and they're kind of like a big
– The UN.
Yeah, actually fairly effective UN of alien species where they're like, you know, we actually don't really have to murder each other all the time. We can actually make this work as a large government. And you have the humans, and the humans are, you know, kind of off on the, doing their own sort of thing. But the thing is that these two have become the dominant political influences in the universe. The conclave, because it is this huge agglomeration, the humans as the counterpoint, and it has shifted the way that things have worked. In previous books in the Old Man's War series, I've made people make the point that the alien species and humans included, with all the intelligent species, were basically at a technological and developmental stasis. Because they were always raiding each other. They were always, you know, picking up each other's technology and modifying it and so on and so forth. So they were all basically at the same level. And since they were all fighting each other, there was that stasis as well. Nobody got too big. Nobody got too small. Occasionally someone would go extinct, but then, you know, everything else would reform itself into a status or an equilibrium. When the conclave happened, that equilibrium went away. And it's not necessarily, you know, you would think that everybody being at peace would be a great thing, but it's not a great thing for everybody. Some people like, you know, the way things were before. It was more advantageous to them. They didn't have to be part of a grand political union where they had to get somebody's permission to go settle a planet. Which
especially
is,
when the Rey like to eat humans.
Right, exactly. There were lots of advantages to, quite frankly, you know, the way things were. And the way things were was this sort of general equilibrium. Now, the equilibrium was also stagnation, but, you know, just in the same way as, you know, people look back at a time 20 or 30 years ago or 50 years ago and say that was a beautiful time, and they forget all the horrible things that happened in that time too because they're looking at it through rose-colored lenses. Same with this equilibrium. They're calling themselves equilibrium not to make a political statement of we're all equal, but to make the political statement of it was better when we all were, you know, on the same level because – and then for whatever reason is that they have. So the equilibrium is seen by them as a positive, would certainly be seen by the conclave and possibly the humans as an extraordinary negative.
I was just thinking about the Rey and their – penchant to eating humans.
Yes.
And that couldn't we all be inoculated with something that would give them like cancer in like a year down the line so all of a sudden everyone would drop dead on their end?
You know what? I encourage you to write that fan fiction. You know, there's lots of things that are – that people come up to me and they ask, well, have you ever thought about this? Or, you know,
well,
maybe you should
not,
do this
and all that sort of thing.
And the answer is yes. A, of course, I can't think of everything. But the other thing is that one of the things that I like to do as a writer – and which is why I don't write those fantasy books that are like 1,000 pages long, which is not an insult to the 1,000-page-long fantasy books, the people who love them or the people who write them. But one of the things I like to do is like leave empty spaces for you to imagine what's going on or to think about the stuff that I don't actively explain. So like, well, couldn't they inoculate us so that we give them cancer when they eat us? It does seem a little... You know, for me, a long way around for a simple problem. It's just easier to shoot them, you know. But you were thinking about it. You actually gave it some thought. And that's actually really exciting to me as a writer is that independent of what was going on in my book, you were thinking outside of the margins in that universe. How awesome is that, that after you put that book down, you were thinking not only, why doesn't this happen? Oh, wait, I know how to fix this. And you've created a part of this universe that is your own headcanon now.
And that's how you kind of create a community, too, that you have people sharing these ideas and you can really
right.
get a good fan base that way.
It's from a business point of view, it's great. But also just from an artistic point of view, the fact that people are thinking about your book long after they're done reading it. I mean, how amazing is that? That you have – they have given you a space in their brain, you know, and the things that you've written, the things that you've created – they like them so much or they've bothered them so much, either way, that they keep coming back to it, either wanting to add onto it or to explain it or to figure out how it would actually work. And for me, in very real way, that is the core of what science fiction is, where you create this world that people love so much that they try to imagine being in it or try to imagine building in it and trying to make it all work. One of the reasons that so much tech looks so much like Star Trek these days, or why we, you know, refer to it, wow, that's a very sort of Star Trek-y sort of thing, is because it just ignited the imagination of so many people who became scientists and engineers and designers and all that sort of stuff. Then they actively tried to build that world so that they could really live in it, not just in their brains. So like I said, you know, when somebody comes to me, says, I've been thinking about this skip drive thing of yours, and here's my theory of how it works, I'm always like, that is awesome. And like, was it right? I don't know. It could be. But the fact that they've spent so much time on it is just, it's incredibly flattering, and it's awesome.
In the second novella, it's narrated by Hafta Sorval.
Yes.
And I can't remember in the short story where Hafta Sorval eats a churro.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that in first person or was that in third person?
That was third person.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what was it like getting into the mind of the alien there?
I loved it. She's one of my favorite characters in the Old Man's War universe. I mean, she's just fantastic. She's an alien, obviously, and it's always fun to get into an alien brain. But she's also someone who is... She is an explicitly political animal, so to speak. I mean, her job, as she sees it, is to make the conclave work. And she understands that in order to do that, you know, there are carrots and there are sticks. And you want to give as many carrots away as you can, but occasionally you'll need to hit somebody with a stick. And you can just be upfront about it. But this is something that I've had to do for you. And even if it's meant to be subterfuge and nothing that can be proven, like she has a conversation with one of the representatives of an alien species where the alien says to her, I know you did this. And she's like, well, yeah, maybe I did. You can't prove it, but we know what the playing field is between the two of us because that's part of the deal. But she is a thinker. She is somebody who is not just involved in things as a bystander, but is an active participant in them. And she also, you know, sees the value of relationships, with the value of relationship with General Gao, who is her boss. You know, the ability to say, honestly, you're doing stupid things here, you know, and have him respond to them or not. And, you know, that sort of feedback between the two of them is wonderful. The other thing is honestly, I think of when I hear her in my brain, and I haven't listened to the audio version of it yet, which I believe her character is narrated by Tavia Gilbert, who previously did Zoe's Tale. I haven't heard it yet, so I can't speak to it, although I'm sure it's going to be wonderful. But in my brain, Hafta Sorval sounds like Helen Mirren. Just that sort of super obvious intelligence, super obvious wit, just on top of things, and just super, super, super smart. I'm using super a lot. It's a good superlative. But the fact is, I love that character. And in many ways, also, what happens in that particular novella, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but it is a fairly significant novella, really is in many ways the turning point for the entire book. And also, of the four novellas, although I really like all of them because they're all four are different and do different things and have the different narrators, and it's very exciting. In many ways, this is my favorite of the four novellas because of her and because of what's at stake in that particular novella.
Old Man's War has been referred to as military sci-fi,
sure,
or space opera, but this one almost seems like diplomatic sci-fi.
Well, in a lot of ways, the story arc of both the Human Division and the End of All Things is about diplomacy, is about everybody realizing that war is leading everybody to ruin. And the thing is that sometimes diplomacy is the courageous thing to do.
But war is just policy by extension, as von Clausewitz would say.
You know, von Clausewitz said a lot of things. You know, just because von Clausewitz says it doesn't mean it's right. But the point of it is that in many ways, war is the path of least resistance. Because it always feels decisive. It always feels like it changes things. Optimally, you have a binary outcome. You either win the engagement or you lose the engagement, and you go on from there. Whereas diplomacy can just really seem inconclusive, and it doesn't seem necessarily to resolve anything, or it's so complicated that you don't get the thrill of accomplishment, right? And so the fact that they've realized that we have to do diplomacy or we're all going to like die in flames is an amazing thing. And even then, it's not necessarily 100% sure that the diplomacy is going to work or that, in fact, it is the best solution. Because, you know, quite frankly, there are situations in this book where one power could survive and the other collapse. And that would be great for that one particular power. You want to keep the balance there. You know, you can make the statement of it is a book about diplomacy, although the third novella is explicitly, you know, military sci-fi candy. But at the end of the day, you have to make people wonder, is this actually the right thing for all the participants in this particular universe? And that's, I think, one of the great tensions of these two books, is to find out whether diplomacy does actually work, or if, in fact, as has happened for the last couple of centuries in this universe, it is actually just better just to shoot the crap out of everybody.
You talked about the B team coming back.
Yeah.
And, of course, everyone's smart aleck. Hart Schmidt is around.
Strange. Well, I like Hart. I think Hart is kind of an everyman in that situation. He's a permanent bystander. You know,
he's not the hero that Harry is.
He's not the person who is going to get covered in glory. He is not the person who you look at and go, him, he's our natural leader. He is the linchpin of this particular operation. But the thing is that Hart does a very important thing in the two books. You know, one, he is a great exposition dude, so that either he can explain or have things explained to him in a way that just doesn't sound like, boom, here's an info drop. But the other thing is that he's also just like everybody else. He's trying to get his way through. In the human division, he's got a whole story where he is, you know, it follows him around. And he's got an entire family of overachievers that are like, what are you doing with your life? Why are you doing this? This is clearly a dead end, you know. And he says, no, this isn't a dead end. All this work that we do is hard, and it's a slog, and it's a pain, and sometimes I have to do ridiculous, humiliating things. But at the end of the day, what it means is that humanity lives another day. He understands that even though he's a cog, you need that cog. Without that one cog, all the flywheels, you know, go off. And so he accepts that he is part of a machine, but being part of a machine means that the machine runs smoothly. And so for me, having him there is great for me as a writer because he's useful, but is great, I think, for the readers as well, because they get a sense of, here is somebody who is meant to represent me. So that's why I'm glad he's there. And he does have his moments of sarcasm, absolutely.
And it does seem that you dip into Earth history as mm-hmm. kind of a template for a lot of the things that are going on around the universe.
Yeah, I think possibly. Part of that is that I'm writing for humans, right? So you have to give them points of reference, or at least I do. I mean, if I were, you know, Chip Delaney or something like that, I might not decide to, you know, have a point of reference for humans. Or China Mieville, who did Embassy Town, where he had a genuinely alien species. Or Ted Chiang, for another example. But for me, I want it to be relatable. So there's going to be a lot of either explicit parallels or things that are reminiscent of things that have happened in human history. And it works for me. I mean, and I think it works for the readers. I mean, we take them out to the furthest reaches of space, right? So you do want to have some structures that they understand. I've had some people come to me and they're like, why do you make the conclave a parliament? And one, because I think certainly as a political entity, parliament just makes sense. You've got so many disparate groups of people. They're literally alien to each other. You put them in a parliament in order just to get them going. But also from a practical point of view, everybody understands what a parliament is and how a parliament works. I don't have to spend a whole lot of time developing that political system. And sometimes it's cool to create a political system that doesn't actually exist and to get into the sort of nitty-gritty in all those little details. But I'm not interested in doing that for these particular stories. These particular stories are about the diplomacy, not necessarily about the Robert's Rules of Order, you know, or the particular ins and outs of the government. It's like, it's a parliament. You understand the parliament? Okay, let's go. So for me, it's a lot of a writer using tropes and shorthands that people already understand to tell a story that is unique in itself, but uses some familiar building blocks.
I like the phrase, the law of conservation of weirdness.
Yes. There's only so far you can go with it. I remember when we were first talking about the Human Division and then the End of All Things, because that was all part of the same project. And we said, we are going to be basically pushing envelopes for how stuff gets distributed, what we're going to charge, you know, all these sorts of things we're going to be asking a lot of readers to follow us to on the back end and on the structure of this. So let's give them a story that we already know that they like and that they're already invested in, which is the old man's war universe. So that despite the episodic nature of it and everything else, that it is something that they know that they're going to be invested in anyway, that they're going to get, they know what they're going to get in terms of the story, that it's going to be in a universe that they already like with characters that they've already met and they have fun with it. So you push them in one direction, you know, and our direction in this one was the episodic nature of it, but you give them something they're familiar with on the other end. You don't always have to do this. There's no reason that you have to do it if you really want to push things. And a lot of great art comes out of pushing. But a lot of great art comes from giving someone a handhold so that they can have a little bit of stability while they look around.
It's like in free jazz. You got to have a head or a little bit of melody.
Right.
So when they're falling down the stairs, they can grab the rail every once
right,
in a while.
Right, exactly. Like sooner or later, you know, you come back to – you got to give them context. And once you give them the context, you can do quite a lot. You know, or, you know, free jazz, perfect example, or a sonnet. You know, sonnet has a very specific structure, but once you have that structure, you can say whatever you want, right? Part of the joy of writing is giving people something that they feel comfortable with and using that to give them something that they don't know that they want. Lock-in, which was the most recent book, I gave them a murder mystery. I also gave them a long-form discussion about disability, right? And I don't ever shove that in people's faces, you know, in terms of making a statement, because also as an able-bodied person, I'm the last person who has the right to do it. Nevertheless, that is part of the, you know, the warp and woof of the story. It's unavoidable. It's there. You can engage it or not, but it's there. And that was made possible by giving them a straightforward murder mystery.
Also, with lock-in, your historical bent. I think it's evident there because it looks like the Spanish influenza with encephalitis lethargica, which was a
pattern
on that.
Yeah, no, the great flu of 1917 through 1919 was a definite model for pattern of distribution and stuff like that.
Well, and lethargica.
Oh yeah, exactly.
After that.
So there's so much going on there that again is relatable. Like I said, and then you step forward from that of, well, you actually have people survive it. What does that survival entail, and what is the new normal that comes out of it? And that was the thing that was fascinating for me. But again, I mean, it's not that I can't be an adventurous writer. I've done stuff that kind of goes way out there in left field. I think God Engines is a good example of that. It's a novella that I wrote that's dark fantasy. But by and large, that's not my primary interest in my particular brand of storytelling.
But recently on your blog, you said you just finished an urban fantasy novella.
Yes, I did. It's called The Dispatcher. I wrote it for Audible. It's going to be a audio novella before it goes to print. And remember how I was saying earlier, I always like to do one thing that's a little bit different for each thing. And this particular one, I was writing it specifically to be spoken, that I knew that.
Pay attention to the rhythms.
Things like when you write a book, you can put dialogue tags, he said, she said. When you hear them in audio, oh, they become annoying. When you read them, you ignore them because your brain sees them, but you know what it says, you just skip over them. In audio, you hear every single one of them, and it just drives me crazy. Like I was listening to Will do Red Shirts, and Will does a wonderful job with Red Shirts. And I think, you know, it's just everything about it is fantastic, except my part where every sentence was he said, she said, he said, she said. And I do that intentionally in the books because I don't want to over elaborate. But I also don't want people to lose track of who's saying what. But yeah, I know I was listening to him and I was like, I'm an idiot with so many dialogue tags.
But couldn't you enable the person directing that to cut out some of those beats?
They don't like to do that because then they have to say it's an abridged version. Right. So when I wrote this piece, when I wrote Dispatcher, it has almost no dialogue tags, which was really interesting for me as a writer because I didn't have the crutch of the dialogue tag to emphasize who was saying what. So it really made me pay attention to my dialogue. And also because it's likely that the novella is going to be read by a narrator who is doing both characters who are, you know, having a dialogue at any one time. I wanted to make sure that there was enough differentiation in the voices that you were never in doubt who it was. So that was kind of a challenge for me, and I'm really excited about it. I'm on tour now, and I'm going to be reading the first chapter of The Dispatchers to the folks that I've seen on tour. They're the only people who are going to hear it before it gets out for general release.
Give us just one sentence.
Oh, man. You're asking me to go off the top of my head. The very first sentence is something along the lines of, nobody is actually happy to see me. I realize this, but Dr. Chow was unhappier than most.
There we go.
Yeah.
So also on your blog, it said it'd probably be a few years before the next Old Man's War book.
Right.
So how many is a few?
You know, I don't know. And I will tell you why. When I finished with Zoe's Tale, I had completed a narrative arc for the Old Man's War universe that started with John Perry and the people he cared about and him stepping into that universe basically as a naive person and him ending his tenure in the universe as someone who literally changes the course of history. So that was a narrative arc, and it changed the history of that universe, as I said. And the history changed, and I didn't know where it was going to go from there. And I was presented with, well, you can keep writing the Old Man's War books and just kind of crank them out and people will buy them and all that sort of stuff. Or you can walk away and actually figure out what you want to do with the universe and come back to it when and if there's a story in it that really intrigues you. And I opted to do the latter because, one, speaking as a writer, just cranking stuff out just does not appeal to me. You know, yes, there's money to be made out of it, but I'm doing okay. I don't really need to do stuff just for the money. I need to be actually intellectually engaged with what I'm doing. So it took me 5 years between Zoe's Tale coming out and The Human Division coming out, 2008, 2013. It took all that time to figure out what I wanted to do and say in the universe. And I knew going in that this was going to be like a two-book deal and that at the end of that, the universe would change again. And so right now, I have no idea what happens next in the Old Man's War universe. Literally do not know. All I know is that I don't feel done with it. I don't feel done with that universe. I feel that there's more that I want to do with it. And so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to, just like they did in the old days where they would have a field that they would let lie fallow for a year, you know, so they could be rained on and the nutrients could get put back into the soil and stuff like that. I'm going to let that particular field lie fallow. Because I did it before and I ended up with a story arc for Human Division and The End of All Things that I really liked and which I think really adds to the universe rather than just accumulates the universe. Do you know what I'm saying? So it could be 3 years down the road. It could be 5 years down the road. It'll be sometime this decade because it's part of this contract that I signed with Tor that goes over the next 10 years. So it'll be sometime before 2025. But where in there? I don't know, and I'm not going to rush it because I have other books that I want to write and other things that I want to do. It will happen when it happens. And what that means for me is that when I do come back to it, it will have been worth the wait.
I want to refer real quick to the sad puppy.
Sad puppies.
Why do you think it is that science fiction draws people from both poles? That you have people with very progressive stances and then you have people with very reactionary stances.
I don't think it's necessarily that science fiction does it per se. I think that in whatever genre that you have people who are liberal, you have people who are conservative, you have people who are somewhere in the vasty middle. And I think that that's the case in science fiction as well. I mean, I was president of Science Fiction Fantasy Writers of America for 3 years. There's 1,800 people in that organization. And of course, there are a great number of science fiction fantasy writers who are not in the organization, although they should be. And that ends my pitch for that. The thing is that of those 1,800 people, there were 1,800 different political perspectives. There are some people who are super, super, super liberal. There are some people who are super, super, super conservative. And there are a lot of people who have political access, you know, whose position on the political map is multidimensional. It's hard to, you know, you would have the people who are pro-gun and pro-choice or, you know, who believe in a socialist distribution of economics and also believe that you should be able to smoke pot anywhere you want to smoke pot. You know, all those sorts of things. Now, what happens is people do tend to notice the people on the polls simply because they often tend to be the loudest or because their politics are significantly divergent from the mainstream enough in either direction that they're often called attention to, like, hey, look at what this idiot is saying. So in that particular case, certainly there is a core of, you know, very conservative science fiction authors. There's a core of very liberal science fiction authors. When they go at it, they kind of skip the vasty middle and just kind of thump on each other. So it can seem like that middle doesn't exist. But that middle does exist, and it's there. And most of them are like, guys, shut up. Not like shut up as in like stop doing what you're doing. It's like, but can't we actually just, you know, there are other things that we can be doing with our time rather than try to pummel each other or to manufacture, you know, crises in science fiction or whatever. So I think that that's the thing. In this particular case with the sad puppies, there was a group of people, and they weren't even necessarily that they were conservative per se, because I think fundamentally it's not about their conservatism so much as a particular sense that their brand of entertainment, their brand of science fiction was being overlooked, and what were the causes for that. And there are lots of conservative science fiction and fantasy writers who don't feel like their brand of science fiction is overlooked or that they are being shut out of awards or whatever. It was a particular group. They do happen to be conservative, but the issue is not that they're conservative. It is what is their own sense of their place in the science fiction community. And then they grafted their own political sense on it, which is not, again, a thing that is exclusive to them. There are folks who have other political points of views who graft their political view onto how they are feeling as well. And does it mean that it's valid, invalid? You know, it really depends on the particular incidents and the particular cases and so on and so forth. But what I want to say is that I don't think that science fiction is particularly polarized. I think that just the polls are very loud.
You have won a Hugo Award yourself. And did
three.
You? Three.
I've won three.
Three.
So excited.
Oh, so and the tone in which you say that kind of moots my question.
What?
I was going to say, did you lose respect for them once you won one?
No. You don't lose respect for them. I mean, the thing is that, you know, one of the things that you are aware of is no matter who you are when you win, there are going to be people like, why did that win? Why did that book win? That book was not Hugo worthy. You look at the list of Hugo winners. Come on. Is that funny? That has been said about every single book that's won a Hugo since I've been cognizant of the Hugos, right? And even the ones of the people like, well, but the Robert Heinlein book, you know, Starship Troopers won. That surely that deserved the Hugo. You'll get a whole bunch of people who go, well, actually, and they'll give you all the reasons why Starship Troopers is a terrible book. And it doesn't matter which book it is. There's always going to be detractors of it. I love the fact that I won a Hugo. I geek out about the fact that I won a Hugo. I've got that Hugo because the best novel Hugo is from San Antonio, and it's made out of brass and is 13 pounds. And if you drop it on your toe, you won't have that toe anymore. And it's on a shelf because my wife put it on a shelf and put stuff around it. And I walk into my office and I look at it, and every time I see it, I smile. I'm like, I got a Hugo. Because when I was a kid, you know, that was the one award that actually was significant to me. I mean, I read more than just science fiction, but science fiction is part of the core of kind of who I am. And so with something said, it's a Hugo winner or a Nebula winner, which is the other award, that meant I wanted to pay attention to it. It didn't mean that I necessarily liked it, but it meant that this was the thing that was on the referendum that year. So to have a book that's won that, or to have the other two, I have a best related book for a collection of essays that I did and a best fan writer thing for what I wrote for my blog. Each of those in their own way is absolutely astounding to me that I've won that. And I just, you know, can't believe it. It doesn't devalue it. I mean, the thing that you feel with it is a certain sort of casualness. It's like, oh, I won the Hugo. Oh, that old thing. Well, you know, a friend of mine won a Oscar. Pam Wallace, she won it for Witness back in 1984-85. And I had reason to want to borrow the Oscar. So I called her up. I was like, do you mind if I borrowed your Oscar for like 3 days? And she's like, yeah, sure, come on down. So she gave me her Oscar for 3 days, right? And the first day that you have the Oscar in your house, you can't stop looking at it. It is the most amazing thing because it's an Oscar, right? And you're like, this is in my house. I didn't win it. It's still in my house. It's an Oscar. The second day, you're like, oh yeah, it's the Oscar. That's pretty cool. The third day, I asked my wife, I was like, where's the gas bill? And she's like, I don't know. Did you look under the Oscar? Because at that point, we were using it as like as a paperweight. And so you become acclimated to it, and then you can feel kind of like, oh, yeah, you know. But it never goes away, the fact that it's cool. Like, I don't care if I win another Hugo ever again. You know what I mean? I've got three. I've got the best novel, Hugo, which is the one which for me is especially significant for my career as an artist. The other two I love equally, but this is the one that matters to the people in the outside world. And having won that, you've rung that bell. I tell people that when we won for Red Shirts, the first thing I did was like, oh, yes. And the second thing is I felt this huge wave of relief, right? Because the pressure was off. I had won it, you know, no matter what, until the end of time, until the heat death of the universe. You know, when they talk about science fiction books, my book and I will be part of that conversation because the Hugos are that significant. It never gets old. It never gets something that, even if you become acclimated to it, even if you become accustomed to it, it's not something that I, for one, take for granted. And I don't think that the folks who are even now, you know, who've been nominated this year, there are some of them who are like, I just voted no award because it's all political or whatever. They're responding to the gravity of the award one way or another. I mean, there's a reason why the Sad Puppies thing happened, because they saw the awards as legitimizing their work and their career and stuff like that. It's not necessarily the right thing to do. There are amazing writers who never won a Hugo while they were alive. I think Ray Bradbury didn't win one until he won a retro Hugo, and that was, you know, 50 years into his career. It is not a referendum necessarily on who you are as a writer or how good your work is. And if you look at it that way, then obviously it's going to be an object of desire and fear and upset when you don't get one or not be considered for one. But I don't think that's the right way of looking for it. If I had never won a Hugo, I would be sad because they're cool and I want one. But I still could have had a wonderful career. You know, I still could have had fans. I still could have written the things that I wanted to write. I could still make a significant impact on my field and on the lives of the people who enjoy my work. Whether or not you get a Hugo out of that or not is in some ways immaterial. It's great to have. It's wonderful to be in that line of authors who've been graced with the good fortune to get one. But at the end of the day, it's a sign, it's a symbol. And there are many other signs and symbols in science fiction and fantasy and in literature that are equally important and equally useful and equally good for the soul. So, you know, my feeling about it is it's great to have. I'm glad I did. I wish that everybody could feel the happiness I have when I have one. But at the end of the day, what really matters is you ask yourself, did I write something good today? Did I write something that somebody's going to want to read? Did I write something that I'm going to be proud of? And if you did, that's actually the reward. That is actually the thing that matters.
Well, that's all fine and good for you, but I'm never winning a Peabody. And that really hurts.
I have a friend who won a Pulitzer. 2001, he won it for Proof, right? David Auburn. And he and I went to college together. I remember the day he won it. I was writing a video game review, right? And I was like, this is my life. I'm writing a video game review. I got paid to play a video game and tell people what I thought about it. This is awesome. Then I go to CNN. Dave Auburn wins a Pulitzer. And I'm like, oh, man, I want a Pulitzer. I want a Pulitzer really bad. But, you know, Dave Auburn did the time. I remember he had a job where he wrote, you know, that fine print on pharmaceutical stuff, you know, please do not take if your heart will explode. That sort of stuff. He was the guy. That was his job. He did his time in the trenches. He deserved that award. Boy, did he deserve it. So after a minute of going, I want that award too, I was like, ah, but, you know, I didn't get it. And he did. And that's awesome for him. I should send him an email. And I did. And goodness gracious, when I won the Hugo, email from Dave Auburn going, right on, dude. So there you have it.
What's the 2016 novel?
The 2016 novel does not have a title yet. It is going to be space opera, presumably. And it's going to be kind of cool because if it works the way I want it to, not only will it have cool speculative physics, but it will also have cool speculative politics and the possibility for the end of the universe as we know it. Lots of characters running around caught in the politics and the physics and everything else, trying to figure things out before it's too late. I'm really excited about it. I need to think about it some more before I start writing it, because I have to start writing it as soon as I get home from the tour.
Well, John, thank you so much for stopping by and talking with us again. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Great to be here.
John Scalzi is the author of The End of All Things, the sixth book in the Old Man's War series, which is published by Tor. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.
Trying to find when Neil Young was on Saturday Night Live when Rockin' in the Free World
came out. Oh, God, that was so great.
That performance was unbelievably good.
Amazingly good.
And I found some, like, Netherlands guy on Netherlands blog had posted on his blog.
Okay. But, yeah, no, because I got to agree with you on that one. I had never been really a Neil Young fan before, really never since.
But that one night.
That performance of Rockin' in the Free World, he just blew the roof.
Just ripped on that Bigsby tremolo and popped all the strings off
at
the end.
Ugh. It was amazing. I was in college for that one, so I remember that. Mm. So, yeah. Nope, we've had our bonding moment here.
Well, we're only like 4 weeks apart in age.
Who's older?
I am.
Are you?
So respect me.
Old man. Yeah, but you have more hair on the top of your head, so.
Probably more everywhere else.
Well, you know, that's more of the information than I need. But I actually just shaved off the back. I had a beard going for about 2 or 3 months, and I shaved it off because my beard has to be assiduously tended or else it goes all tufty. Mm-hmm. And then I look like the guy that you call the cops on. Right? I mean, there's no intermediary stage. It goes from looks okay to you got to come get him away. He's scaring the children. Right, exactly. And I can't travel with my trimmer because they'll just confiscate it at TSA. So last night I just shaved it all off. And so, you know, it's – and then when I go back home, I will probably re-beard. But you know, for now, it's clean shaven is kind of the way to go.
Now, I saw the I got the installments as they came out, the episodes as
sure.
came out. And you had a double neck guitar for your author photo. Now, is that an SG?
No, it's an Eastwood. This is a great thing because
I know the Eastwood company. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a Warren Ellis, not that Warren Ellis, the other Warren Ellis.
So it's got the tenor guitar on it?
It's a tenor guitar on the bottom and mandolin slash uke up on the top. So, yeah, I don't know. It's great. Do you have a copy of the book? It's in the back of the book, so you can see the picture. But it's,
well, you can't really see it because it's in
kind of going,
you see it head on.
But I can pull up a picture of it so you can see it. But the thing about it is that I can't play a real guitar. You know, the six-string guitar is just too many strings. It confuses me. And I can't do bar chords. You know, for some reason or other, they just don't work for me. But a tenor guitar has four strings. And so I play the tenor guitar. I tune it the same way.
Do you tune a guitar tuning or to violin tuning?
No, I actually tune it to uke tuning.
Okay.
Because I was playing ukuleles first, and so the ukulele.
So you put the fat string in the second position?
Yeah, it's a reentrant sort of thing. Or you can just do the G string as a lower G string.
Like a baritone uke.
Yeah, either works just fine. But the thing about it is that you know, so that way I don't have to learn a second set of chords. It sounds great because the guitar is actually a really good guitar. But yeah, no, one of the things that I was saying is like if I finish this book, you know, I'm going to buy myself an electric tenor guitar. And I knew that Eastwood makes them because Warren Ellis.
I've actually watched the video of the guy from Eastwood and Warren talking about it.
Yeah. So that they actually, you know.
That almost looks like, was it like. Did Mose Wright make an old kind of like a mandolin guitar combo
in
the
so.
60s?
Yeah. But the thing about it is that I was just going to get like a regular just electric guitar. And then I saw that they had this thing. And my model was like a floor model somewhere. So it was reduced in price. So it was the same cost as the regular one. I'm like, I'm buying that. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, you look at it and you're like, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever bought.
How much does it weigh?
It's fairly heavy. I think it's probably like, you know, I don't know, 10 pounds or something like that. I mean, it's really solid. But it plays fantastically well. Eastwood makes good guitars and I just have so much fun with it because just being there with your own double neck guitar and it being a tenor guitar and uke, because I have it strung as a uke on the top, is just fundamentally ridiculous, which is what makes it especially fun. So that's just me.
I was wondering because at the Gibson Guitar Factory here, they make the SG,
yeah,
American double neck.
Yeah.
Because they make most of the solid bodies in Nashville.